This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years with the arrival of Anniversary Blend Coffee and Tea. Portland locations on the web at PEETS.com.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, an electronic components manufacturer and its chairman were indicted today on charges alleging they schemed to defraud the U.S. military.
For the Eugene Report, Amy Merwin tells us how campus police are planning to arm their officers at the University of Oregon in Eugene.
May has marked the highest monthly death toll in Iraq since the invasion began.
And a closer look into the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,475 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 42,646 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as a quarter million dead.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, June 6, 2006. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Josonia Watson. Three men were attacked Saturday in what police say is a possible hate crime. The assault occurred about 2 a.m. as the men left the Escape nightclub at Southwest Stark Street and 10th Avenue. The victim said several men began verbally harassing them about their sexual orientation and then started throwing punches. The suspects were described as two men in their 20s, about 5'10 and 5'11, and weighing 175 to 185 pounds. No arrest have been made. The case is being forwarded to a biased crime detective for further investigation.
The city of Eugene has asked a federal judge to dismiss a $1 million lawsuit that alleges city police policy allows traffic stops based on racial profiling. The lawsuit stems from September 2004. A police officer stopped Cortez Jordan, a black man, walking away from a nightclub. He was frisked, but his four white companions were not. The incident outraged minority leaders and prompted several members to resign from the city's racial profiling task force. Jordan's lawyer quotes a 2002 study of Eugene traffic stops that showed that young men of color were significantly more likely to be stopped than white males. The city has denied there is any evidence of a police policy or custom that allows officers to do traffic stops based on race. A U.S. magistrate judge did not indicate when he would rule on the issue.
At the University of Oregon in Eugene, campus police are preparing to equip their officers with tasers. For the Eugene Report, Amy Merwin has more.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. On May 31st, an article in the Oregon Daily Emerald was headlined, Campus Officers Request Tasers. Here to tell us about what the use of taser guns by the public safety officers at the University of Oregon campus might mean is academic advisor and long-term Amnesty International activist Karen Kennedy.
The taser gun, manufactured by Taser International, is a stun weapon that fires 50,000 volts of electricity via two wires led by piercing darts. They can be shot up to distances of 21 feet. They can also be applied close range to an individual. A person who's been shot with a taser will experience severe pain, a loss of muscle control. They often go into spasm, and it causes the person to collapse.
There have been major injuries and even deaths associated with even what's considered the appropriate and proper use of tasers.
If people would like to read extensive reports on the taser weapon, they can access those on the Amnesty International and the American Civil Liberties Union website. Both have been documenting deaths by tasers over the last few years. So far, the number of people dying after being shocked with tasers has been steadily increasing every year. 61 people died in 2005, and at least 152 people have died in the U.S. since 2001.
What is the rationale for using tasers?
Tasers are now used by over 7,000 of the 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States. Taser claims, and so do law enforcement, that they reduce injuries and save lives by giving officers an alternative to using firearms and batons. Taser International encouraged liberal use of its weapon and promoted it as a non-lethal weapon that saves lives and grossly downplays the safety concerns.
Why would Taser International downplay the safety concerns?
They're making huge profits. Any research that has been done on the safety has been conducted by people associated with Taser, and it hasn't met most research criteria to find out what the safety issues are for Tasers, so it's not in their interest to provide that, considering the mounting deaths coming from those weapons.
The University of Oregon public safety officers say that they are handling a lot more difficult cases than they did 10 years ago, that they are only equipped with batons and pepper spray. Therefore, they need the tasers. Have you learned about an increase in more difficult behavioral problems that would require the use of stunning someone into unconsciousness?
I think they're definitely feeling less safe. The issues that they're dealing with, though, have been long-term ongoing issues. Amnesty supports the development of non-lethal alternatives to firearms, and police officers should have the tools they need to do their job safely and effectively. However, Amnesty's research shows that tasers are being used in situations where police use of lethal force or even batons would never be justified. So rather than being used as a last resort in a highly dangerous situation, Amnesty found that tasers are being used for routine situations. We're very concerned about how this weapon is open to abuse. The taser is portable, it's easy to use, and a person can inflict severe pain at the push of a button without leaving any substantial marks. So despite all this, there's been little public scrutiny of this weapon, and there's been no consistent standards or guidelines on their use. In only a few states is there a restriction on the number of times an officer may fire a taser at a suspect. Amnesty International and ACLU have both documented cases in which victims were stunned repeatedly before they died. Both found that many U.S. police agencies are using tasers as a routine option to subdue unarmed, noncompliant individuals who do not pose a serious danger to themselves or others, and in some cases, this has constituted ill treatment and torture. Human rights and civil liberties groups are concerned about the spreading use of tasers by law enforcement. Organizations are recording the use of tasers on people that have pre-existing medical problems. Officers are using those with people who are not violent. They're just not complying with the demand that the officer is making. We have reports of people being stunned when they're already handcuffed and in restraints. They're also being used within the prison. This is a real concern for abuse of this weapon.
Many people believe the use of tasers suppress dissent.
Taser International sells its weapons to governments worldwide, and tasers are being used for human rights abuses. It includes using them in those types of situations.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
With energy costs on the rise, concerns about global warming and the U.S. foreign policy increasingly based on protecting dwindling energy supplies, hundreds of Oregonians have already installed solar energy systems in their homes. This week, the Energy Trust of Oregon is holding two seminars on the benefits of solar power. KBOO's Evening News Director Lisa Loving spoke with Keisha Brockman at Energy Trust.
Keisha, tell us about the work you're doing, exactly what aspect of solar power you're focusing on.
We'll be giving a presentation on the fact that solar works in Oregon, how these systems can help you handle some of your energy load in your homes, how much they cost, and what the value of the incentives are. And we'll also have some local contractors there that you can talk to about potentially getting set up at your own home.
What kind of response are you getting from these workshops as you go out there?
Particularly in 2006, we've seen a great interest in solar energy, a dramatic increase. We've had over 100 people attend the seminars that we've done so far this year. I think a couple things have spurred that. One, just a general rising awareness of our energy situation, as well as the global warming and environmental issues. And two is that the federal government passed some tax credits for homeowners who invest in solar electric and solar water heating systems that have made them more attractive than ever.
Are there surprises about solar power that you hear from people? Is it easier than people think?
Yes, I think so. I think the main surprise is that solar works in Oregon. People tend to think that we live in a really cloudy environment. And we have a very good solar resource on an annual basis. For us, it's seasonal. We have great sunny summers, and then we have darker winters with shorter days. But on an annual basis, we get as much or more sun as they do in Germany, which is the world leader in the installation of solar energy systems.
So what kind of things can people expect to operate in their homes if they create a solar energy grid?
Yes, there are some things that are important to realize. If you install a solar electric system, you have solar panels that are mounted usually on your roof, and they generate electricity. There's a box that converts that electricity into the type that you can use in your home, which is exactly the same as what you get from the electric power company. Anything that's turned on in your home will first use the energy generated from your solar energy system. If that's not generating enough, you can draw additional electricity from the grid. If it's generating more than enough, that excess electricity is passed out to the grid for others to use, and you get credit for it on your meter. There's also solar water heating, which is different in that it heats water, and it preheats water that goes to your existing water heater. Your water heater can be gas or electric. Your water heater then has to do less work because it's warming preheated water. The seminars that we're offering, there's one tonight in Corvallis at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship at 2945 Northwest Circle Boulevard, again in Corvallis. There's one tomorrow night in Portland. It's near Tigard at the Earth Advantage National Center on Boone's Ferry Road. The address is 16280 Southwest Upper Boone's Ferry Road. Both of these are free. They both begin at 7 o'clock. They last for about an hour.
Do you have a website?
Energytrust.org.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with Keisha Brockman.
The State Department of Environmental Quality has fined a gun club more than $17,000 for illegally dumping lead-contaminated debris. The actions of the Medford Rifle and Pistol Club threaten groundwater, wildlife, and other environmental elements, DEQ officials said yesterday. Two samples analyzed by DEQ indicated concentrations of lead at 1,240 parts per million and 33.8 parts per million. Waste containing 5 or more parts per million is considered toxic and hazardous, the agency said. Jim Rice, the president of the gun club, said the group's plan to oppose the fine and won't pay the state until the appeals process has been exhausted. But Rice said its members will work with DEQ on any further cleanup around the property. Club members were aware of the dangers of lead poisoning and obtained a bid for proposed disposal from an environmental consultant. But the club members deemed it too expensive, DEQ officials said.
60 years after chemical weapons training was conducted on the Tulalip Reservation in Washington State, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is investigating whether toxic materials were left behind. Crews from a company under contract with the federal government began investigating the site last month. They have cleared brush from the heavily wooded site just west of Quail Seda Village and used ground-penetrating radar to search for unusual material. An Army spokesman said, quote, unnatural materials, unquote, have already been found, but they don't know yet what they are. The depot was one of 91 sites nationwide identified as areas with possible chemical weapon storage. Said David Hurdle, site safety and health officer with Parsons, the company contracted by the federal government to do the cleanup. Tribal leaders hope to develop part of the site and restore the rest to wetlands.
There's a gap between minority children and their white counterparts when it comes to getting health care. That, according to a new report from the Children's Defense Fund. KBOO's Spencer Raymond has more.
Minority children in Oregon are getting the short end of the deal when it comes to health care. A new report from the Children's Defense Fund shows Latino and black children are far more likely than their white counterparts to lack health insurance and access to health care. Tina Kotek with Children First for Oregon says Oregon's no different. She says 36% of all uninsured children in Oregon are Hispanic, even though they represent only 15% of the child population.
We want to make sure every child is healthy so they can succeed, and any improvements we make in terms of expanding access will be meaningless if we have entire groups of children going without health care.
In Oregon, about one of every eight children lacks health insurance. Report Arthur Marty Telebaum with the Children's Defense Fund says Latino children are more than three times more likely, and black children are nearly 50% more likely than white children to be uninsured.
A lot of it, though, is income. higher income children of all races be more likely to be insured.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
The Portland-based International Center for Traditional Childbearing will lead a national delegation of midwives to Sierra Leone to help address the issue of infant mortality there. In a recent interview with KBOO's Lisa Loving, ICTC founder Sheila Monroe explained how this trip fits with the mission of her organization.
ICTC began, that's the abbreviation, ICTC, International Center for Traditional Childbearing. We birthed in 1991 in Portland, Oregon. We are officially an infant mortality prevention, a midwife training, and pregnancy support organization. And we formed because infant mortality rate was so high in this country. And recently, World Health Organization just put across that, once again, the United States is second highest of the industrialized nations. And about 21 other countries are doing better than us as industrialized nations. But within the country, you have pockets that are doing worse than the average. So basically, African Americans have the highest death rate for their babies of any other race. And the average is about 5 births per 1,000. And for African Americans, running 11 to 12 per 1,000, depending on what state you're in. And the whole goal, of course, that I want to say is universal peace, universal love. And we're using midwifery as a venue to get into the community, into the homes, as all cultures did around the world, where women were the ones that promoted love, kindness, you know, anti-violence, and using birth as that medium. And so we have a high school program called Sister Care. These are girls who are anywhere from 13 to 18 who come to our center every week for a whole school year, and they graduate knowing how to take care of themselves, more importantly, how to be mediators in the community, in their family, and how to stay in school to continue the health profession. We have doula trainings, women who want to be doulas, which is another profession of how you work with the pregnant family. And we say family because it's not just the mom. We're working also with the significant other because that person's not alone. And we know that a lot of stress that comes about being pregnant. And, of course, we offer direct services such as free pregnancy testing and free prenatal care for uninsured people. We have a fantastic conference every year called the Annual Black Midwives and Healers Conference. And we're getting responses actually around the world to come with our conference. So people are actually bidding. So it's very exciting. It's amazing. We're really proud to be in Portland, but yet have our arms extended around the world to capture the essence of midwifery for all women and families. So we'll be going for 2 weeks to help the families of Sierra Leone, West Africa, improve their birth outcomes. And because of the Civil War that ended in 2002, the infant mortality rate in Ceylon is very high. So out of 1,000 births, approximately 143 babies will die. We'll be bringing medical supplies with us and clothes and training materials. We'll be working with women who want to be midwives or have been doing births because of they had no choice. There's no one else around but them, but they need some more skill building. And we were invited to lead this delegation, and I think they chose because we do have an African-centered philosophy within our organization. And I think there's a camaraderie and a similarity because we're both suffering as African-Americans and as African on the homeland from high death rates of our babies, and we're suffering from our midwifery being pulled from us. And so I think having the similar experience in America and then going to Africa is just a full circle for our mission. Our mission has always been to go to Africa and do this work, which is why we chose the name International Center. We need some supplies. You know, we need stainless steel scissors. We're looking for stethoscopes and fetal scopes and blood pressure cups. And we need cotton receiving blankets. We need clean baby cotton T-shirts. And we're accepting donations up until June 7th at 2823 North Portland Boulevard in the North Minister Presbyterian Church. And we can bring them to the families in Sierra Leone. And, of course, I must say dollars. We have not gotten any federal or public money. We've generated the funds out of our own pockets to do this trip, so we're not being funded by anyone. We are a 501c3. It is a tax write-off. We get back on the 24th. We're going to have a big celebration and do a fact-finding. What are the people of Sierra Leone saying that they really need from American people and what we can do to continue? Because to go one time and then leave people hanging is not what we want to do. We want to go, get something going, find out what the needs are, and continue the relationship, you know, as an organization here. Call us at 503-460-9324, and our website is www.blackmidwives.org. That's BLACKMIDWIVES.org. And again, I just think it's really great that our organization is racially diverse, but the leadership is coming from African-American organization. I think that's just really phenomenal coming out of Oregon. So I really think Oregon's done a great job, Portland in particular, of supporting the work that we do as an agency here, and just encouraging people to continue the support that we've been getting over the years.
The Federal Way Washington City Council will decide tonight whether to make it a separate crime to commit domestic violence in the presence of a child. The law was proposed by Councilman Jim Farrell, who is a deputy King County prosecutor. He says children who witness domestic violence suffer psychological scars but are overlooked as victims. State and city law already make it a crime to assault or threaten a spouse or partner. If it's done in the presence of a child, the new law in Federal Way would add at least 30 days to the sentence.
The Northwest Animal Rights Network has sued the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle over the treatment of an unsociable elephant named Bamboo. The group says Bamboo should be sent to a 2,700-acre animal sanctuary in Tennessee to give her more room. Bamboo is currently at the Point Defiance Zoo in Tacoma because she wasn't getting along with other elephants in Seattle, especially 5-year-old Hansa. The lawsuit filed in King County Superior Court says the Seattle Zoo has failed to provide Bamboo space for roaming, foraging, and bonding with other elephants. A zoo spokeswoman, Gigi Alanich, says its lawyer is preparing a response.
A Fort Lewis lieutenant will be the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment to Iraq based on moral opposition to the war. He'll refuse to go when his striker brigade is deployed this month. The officer, Army First Lieutenant Aaron Watata, will explain his refusal at a news conference tomorrow in Tacoma. In a statement set up by supporters, he says he refuses, quote, to be party to an illegal and immoral war against people who did nothing to deserve our aggression. Watata's lawyer says he first asked to be reassigned, then asked to resign. The Army rejected both requests. A Fort Lewis spokeswoman had no comment. The officer could be charged with desertion.
And an electronic components manufacturer and its chairman were indicted today on charges alleging they schemed to defraud the U.S. military of millions of dollars. Hurley Industries Incorporated and Lee N. Blatt, the Lancaster, Virginia-based company's founder and board chairman, allegedly reaped profits of up to 300% on more than $3.9 million in sales of electronic components, for which it was the only supplier, according to the grand jury indictment. The company sold an oscillator used in F-16 fighter jet radar systems and a component that prevents power surge damage on E-2C Hawkeye aircraft. The 29-count indictment includes charges of wire fraud, lying to the government, obstruction, aiding and abetting, and major fraud against the United States.
The U.S. has deployed a first contingent of National Guard troops along its border with Mexico. This is part of an operation aimed at curbing illegal immigration. Some 55 soldiers from the Utah National Guard took up positions along border points with Mexico. They will be joined by 6,000 more in the coming months. The issue is dividing the U.S., provoking fierce debate in Congress between Republicans and Democrats on how stringent the measures could or should be. The soldiers' job to help secure the border rather than assist immigrants or arrest immigrants and to free up border agents to catch illegal immigrants. They will help to extend a border fence and construct a new road to be used by Border Patrol. The governor of the state of Washington, Christine Gregoire, says that she will not send any of her state's National Guard troops unless they choose to serve there. The governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, only agreed to commit troops after the federal group said it would carry the full cost of their deployment.
United for Peace and Justice has organized a coalition of organizations, all of which are asking their members to phone their U.S. congressmen on Wednesday, June 7th, to urge them to sign a discharge petition that would force, for the first time, a full and open debate on Iraq on the floor of the House of Representatives. Participating organizations include AfterDowningStreet.org, American Friends Service Committee, Backbone Campaign, Code Pink, Democracy Rising, Democrats.com, and more. The discharge petition, House Resolution 543, currently has 122 signatures, including five Republicans. If 218 Congress members sign it, a bill on the Iraq War will be forced to the floor, and a 17-hour debate will ensue, with that time evenly split between parties, and with an open rule, meaning that all amendments can be offered, debated, and voted on.
The trial continues today of the 12 protesters who blocked the military recruiting station in Colorado last year. Sam Pokwa reports from Boulder.
The group calls themselves the No Blood for Oil 12. They're accused of trespassing and obstructing a passageway at a military recruitment center in Lakewood, Colorado, last November. The action coincided with several other protests at military recruiting stations across the country. The U.S. military has been falling short of its recruitment quotas and has been accused of targeting largely disadvantaged youth and minority groups with promises of college scholarships and other bonuses. The defendants say their civil disobedience actions are justified under international law and U.S. law. They are defending themselves during the trial, which is expected to go to jury this afternoon. In Boulder, Colorado, I'm Sam Fuqua for FSRN.
The Iraqi Health Ministry said that nearly 1,400 civilians in Baghdad alone died in targeted attacks in the month of May, marking the highest monthly death toll since the invasion began. David Enders reports.
The war of bodies in the streets of Baghdad has increased in intensity since February in the destruction of a major Shiite shrine. In May, 1,398 bodies were brought to the central morgue, according to the official Ministry of Health statistics, 243 more than in April. The count doesn't include soldiers or civilian victims of explosions. According to the LA Times, since 2003, at least 30,240 bodies have been brought to the morgue, the vast majority of them shot by gunmen who are seldom caught or prosecuted. Bodies are sometimes placed in the street as a warning and lay unclaimed for hours. Mustafa Al-Hithi is a member of the Iraqi parliament, which meets in a heavily fortified green zone.
All the people go home like chickens at 5 to 6 o'clock, and you can find all the streets are empty.
I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
U.S. military investigators believe the killing of an Iraqi civilian on April 26th was planned by a small group of Marines who shot the man and then planted a shovel and an AK-47 rifle at the scene, a senior Pentagon official said today. The official, who has directed, who has direct knowledge of the investigation underway by the Naval Criminal Investigative Services, said evidence found thus far indicates Marines entered the town of Hamdania in search of an insurgent and failing to find him, grabbed an unarmed man from his home and shot him. The AK-47 and the shovel, which were taken from another home before the shooting, were meant to make it look like the man had been digging a hole for a roadside bomb and was killed in an exchange of gunfire, the official said. The officially spoke only of a condition of anonymity because it was not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. Seven Marines and a naval corpsman are being investigated in this case, but no charges have been filed. All eight were removed from duty with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment in Iraq and being held at Camp Pendleton, California.
Personal data on more than 2.2 million active duty military troops, not just 50,000 as reported yesterday, were among the material stolen from a Veterans Affairs employee last month, the Pentagon said today. In a briefing paper to Congress, the Defense Department said a VA understated figures when it said up to 50,000 Navy and National Guard troops and no other active duty personnel were affected by the May 3rd burglary. In fact, names, birth dates, and social security numbers of more than 1.1 million active duty troops from all the armed forces, along with more than 1 million National Guard and Reserve personnel, were also stolen, according to a Pentagon briefing paper distributed to Congress. A copy was obtained by the Associated Press. The disclosure is the latest in a series of revisions by the government as to who was affected since publicizing the burglary on May 22nd. At the time, the VA said the stolen data involved up to 26.5 million veterans discharged since 1975, as well as some of their spouses. A VA spokesman did not have an immediate comment.
Five national veterans group joined in filing a class action lawsuit against Secretary of Veterans Affairs James Nicholson, as well as the Department of Veterans Affairs itself. The class action lawsuit charges that the VA flagrantly disregarded the privacy rights of veterans by illegally maintaining a database of personal information. The lawsuit is in response to the May 3rd theft of sensitive electronic information at the Montgomery County, Maryland home of VA data analyst FSRN's Selena Mustuda reports.
This is the second lawsuit since the Department of Veterans Affairs, or VA, disclosed 2 weeks ago that the medical and financial information of millions of military veterans and their spouses had been stored in a stolen laptop and external data storage device. Critics of the VA say that they failed to implement minimal security safeguards to protect the identities of veterans.
None of that information, 26.5 million records of names, addresses, phone numbers, Social Security numbers, disability status, and perhaps more, was encrypted in any way.
Douglas Rosinski, an attorney defending the class action lawsuit, is asking the court to place the handling of sensitive VA records under court supervision.
We're fundamentally asking is the courts that the judge supervise and take jurisdiction over that part of the Veterans Administration to ensure that outside experts are brought in and that the appropriate policies and procedures for information security are applied in the department, as every other part of the government is required to do under the law.
Some veterans advocates, like Richard Weidman, were not surprised that the personal information of veterans was compromised. Weidman has received countless calls from members of his organization, Vietnam Veterans of America, expressing their fears that their financial stability could be compromised and anger that the VA took 3 weeks before notifying the public. He says many veterans also question why the data analyst had access to their files in the first place.
At one point, VA said that they had all of this data to help veterans get buried in the national cemeteries. That's ridiculous, because the Office of Policy and Planning, where this analyst worked, does not have an operational arm. Veterans Benefits Administration and the National Cemetery Administration have an operational arm, but Policy and Planning Office does not. So what kind of work, what kind of projects were going on? What were they doing with this personal data of veterans?
The plaintiffs are asking for monetary damages in the amount of $1,000 for each person affected by the privacy violation, as well as full disclosure to each veteran of their personal records. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I am Selena Masuda.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear a special edition of Out Loud, followed by Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Amanda's Jam Corner. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, low to 50 to 55. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high 65 to 70, lows 50 to 55. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River. Personal data on more than 2.2 million active duty military troops, not just 50,000 as reported yesterday, were among the material stolen from a Veterans Affairs employee last month, the Pentagon said today. In a briefing paper to Congress, the Defense Department said the VA understated figures when it said up to 50,000 Navy and National Guard troops and no other active duty personnel were affected by the May 3rd burglary. In fact, names, birth dates, and Social Security numbers of more than 1.1 million active duty troops from all of the armed forces, along with more than 1 million National Guard and Reserve personnel, were also stolen, according to a Pentagon briefing paper distributed to Congress. A copy was obtained by the Associated Press. The disclosure is the latest in a series of revisions by the government as to who was affected since publicizing the burglary on May 22nd. At the time, the VA said that the stolen data involved up to 26.5 million veterans discharged since 1975, as well as some of their spouses. A VA spokesman did not have an immediate comment.
The current time is 5:34, and now time for another highfalutin daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Back in my school days, there were a couple of kids who always seemed able to get a note from their mother excusing them from doing their homework or even going to class. George W. must have had a mama like that. Now that he's grown, whenever Bush gets caught doing something wrong, torturing prisoners in Iraq, for example, or secretly and illegally spying on millions of innocent Americans, George simply pulls out a note from his mama saying it's okay. Only, as president, his mama's note comes from his White House lawyers or his Justice Department appointees, who invariably excuse his bad behavior. Now, Bush's mommy lawyers have taken a further step, excusing him even from any pesky questioning about who is writing these notes. Early this year, Representative Maurice Henschy asked the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility to examine who in the department has actually authorized Bush's domestic spy program and why. News reports have revealed that top-ranking officials at Justice had refused the White House request for them to rubber stamp such obviously illegal spying. So, who signed the authorization? It was a straightforward and important question. We're not asking for top-secret information, noted Henschy. Yet only 4 months after beginning its probe, the OPR sent a fax to Henschy saying that it was abruptly closing the inquiry. Why? Because unnamed lawyers from higher up had ruled that OPR's investigators could not have security clearances for questioning any aspect of the spy program. Without these clearances, wrote an OPR official, we cannot investigate this matter. This is Jim Hightower saying, in short, the very Bushites who excused themselves from obeying the law and the Constitution have now excused themselves from answering any questions about it. Henschy, however, still wants some answers. To support him, call his office, 202-225-6335. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Billy Preston, the exuberant keyboardist who landed dream gigs with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and enjoyed his own hit singles including Out of Space and Nothing from Nothing, died today at 59. His longtime manager, Joyce Moore, said a heart infection in November left him in a coma and he never regained consciousness. He was taken to Scottsdale Hospital Saturday after his condition deteriorated. Preston had battled chronic kidney failure and received a kidney transplant in 2002, but the kidney failed and he was on dialysis ever since. Known for his big gap tooth smile and towering afro, Preston was a teen prodigy on the piano and organ and lent his gospel-tinged touch to classics such as The Beatles, Get Back, and The Stones' Can't You Hear Me Knocking. He also wrote Joe Cocker's You Are So Beautiful.
Colorado's primary elections are just weeks away, and there's growing concern in the state and around the nation over the introduction of voting machines. FSRN's Maeve Conrad reports from Boulder, where a lawsuit has been filed claiming the machines are inaccurate, susceptible to security violations, and inaccessible to handicapped voters.
Colorado purchased several computerized voting systems to comply with the sweeping reforms laid out in the Help America Vote Act of 2002. Last Thursday, a coalition of nonpartisan voter advocates filed a lawsuit against the Secretary of State of Colorado and county commissioners to stop the use of these new voting machines. Paul Holton is one of the attorneys involved in the suit.
It is our belief, and it's well documented, that these computerized voting systems are insecure, are easily hacked into and compromised, and present an unprecedented opportunity for election fraud.
At a public hearing on the new voting machines held last week, some disabled advocates spoke out in support of the machines. They say they facilitate private voting for the disabled. Attorney Paul Holton says that the machines do not benefit disabled voters.
It's our belief that these machines are way oversold in terms of what they do for disabled people. It's our position that they do not comply with the requirements for disabled voters. And in any event, disabled voters want to know that their vote is secure and that their vote will be counted and that they won't be voting on machines that can be tampered and fraudulently changed.
Spokeswoman for the Secretary of State, Dana Williams, says the machines have been rigorously tested and that the Secretary of State is very confident in the certification process used in the state of Colorado. Electronic voting machines were introduced as a result of HAVA, which sparked a spate of lawsuits across the country, including California.
HAVA stands for Help America Vote Act, and it was implemented so badly that we now call it the Help Yourself to America's Vote Act.
Bev Harris of the group Black Box Voting says the changes brought by HAVA compliance requirements have wreaked havoc on the voting system.
I think it will become very interesting to see how it was actually architected into place, but there was a tremendous amount of money put in by lobbyists and that represented certain portions of the industry that hoped to make a profit.
With the millions of dollars earmarked by HAVA for these new voting machines, electronic voting looks set to be a lucrative industry. And with state elections looming, Harris predicts many similar lawsuits across the country as voters stand up to makers of electronic voting machines. In Boulder, Colorado, this is Maeve Conran for Free Speech Radio News.
The City Council of New London, Connecticut, voted to evict the two remaining homeowners in a fight over eminent domain that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
The city has been trying to take the land for 7 years to use in a private redevelopment plan that includes a hotel, office space, and upscale private housing. Last summer, the Supreme Court sided with the city, prompting debates about limiting the power of eminent domain in state legislatures around the country, as well as in the U.S. Congress. One of the two remaining plaintiffs lost a house in New London to eminent domain for another project almost 40 years ago. Italian immigrant Pasquale Cristoforo says he won't go willingly this time. In an emotional three-hour hearing before the vote, his son Michael said, "If you want to see an 81-year-old man who loves this country and has never been arrested, be handcuffed and hauled away along with every member of the Cristoforo family, continue along the path you are going. We won't be leaving," he said. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
The Senate is at it again, debating a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. While critics say the issue is merely an election year tactic to rally political bases, many in the African American community are supporting both sides of the issue. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
It's common in an election year for Congress to consider amending the Constitution to define marriage between a man and a woman. It is a political showdown which has little chance of obtaining the two-thirds majority necessary to pass. Republicans, though, aren't calling this attempt anti-gay, but rather to protect the democratic process. Republican Senator Wayne Allard from Colorado, co-sponsor of the amendment.
What the issue is do you want to continue to allow the courts to overturn these issues that the legislature and the people in our states have voted on? And I think that we protect the Democrat process. The Democrat process is under assault, as well as the family.
But in 2003, a Massachusetts court ruled that same-sex couples could marry. 18 states, though, have already amended their constitution to ban same-sex marriage, and 27 states have laws restricting marriage to a man and a woman. All Democrats, except for Ben Nelson of Nebraska, oppose the measure. They say the constitution should not be amended. Senator Frank Lautenberg from New Jersey.
The amendments we've made to the constitution, only once did we restrict rights, prohibition, and it didn't take long to repeal that. The American people weren't going to obey the law, and they violated it in every way and finally said, why create laws that don't mean anything to people?
The black community came out in both support and opposition to the amendment. Those who oppose it say the Constitution cannot be used to discriminate. Wade Henderson is executive director of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights.
More importantly, would be the first time the U.S. Constitution is used affirmatively to discriminate against one group of Americans, in our view, is an especially significant problem.
And those who support the amendment say the black family is in disarray. Therefore, the traditional marriage must be preserved. Star Packer is with the Coalition for Urban Renewal and Education.
We've already seen in black America what happens when family is destroyed. We have 4,000 housing projects that these women are living in. Yes. We've seen what happens when they're living without a husband who loves his wife and their children, raising them together in matrimony. We've seen what happens when we tell young men that they can do whatever they desire in terms of their sexual passions, when they go into the jails and they come back into these 4,000 housing projects. Mm-hmm. Today, AIDS is the number one killer of African-American women between 25 and 35.
But writer and activist Kenyon Farrell says that a ban on same-sex marriage will not solve the problems of the black community.
I think that there is sort of a false, false mystery or romanticization of, you know, sort of a time, you know, in the black community when there were, you know, everyone was, you know, married and in these heterosexual marriages and arrangements and everything was great and good. And that, you know, will solve, you know, the problem of imprisonment or will solve the problem of high rates of HIV or homelessness or any of the other ills that, you know, the black community is dealing with right now.
As for the general debate on same-sex marriage, he says it is misguided. Instead, it should focus on giving the benefits of married couples to all, whether they're in a romantic relationship or not.
I shouldn't have to get married in order to determine who the people are around me that I want to visit me at my bedside if I'm ever hospitalized. I shouldn't have to get married if I want to decide, you know, who, you know, I sort of want to give, you know, any property to in the, you know, case that I die or any sort of arrangement like that, you know. So what I think would be helpful is for, you know, us to really look at what are the different ways that people are actually living their lives.
The Senate could end the discussion tomorrow if they vote the measure down. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Two women asking Britain to recognize their Canadian same-sex marriage argued in court today that their relationship is like that of any other married couple. They say calling it a civil partnership violates their human rights. Sue Wilkinson and Celia Kitzinger, both university professors, have been together for 16 years. They exchanged vows 3 years ago during a ceremony in Canada where same-sex marriages are legal. Last year, Britain enacted the Civil Partnership Bill, which gives same-sex couples the right to form legally binding partnerships and entitling them to most of same-sex tax and pension rights married couples possess. Britain's Attorney General and Lord Chancellor, the country's senior legal figure, are opposing the motion. The case is scheduled to last 3 days, with a decision expected in July.
Serbs in northern Kosovo say they will cut ties with the UN because of a series of attacks against them. In recent days, one Serb has been killed and two others injured. The UN investigated the attacks and said they were not ethnically motivated, despite Serbian claims that they were carried out by ethnic Albanians. Tensions remain high between Kosovo's ethnic Albanians and its Serb minority, while talks on the future of the UN-administered province continue.
The Indian government plans to sponsor some provincial authorities to counter Maoist. It has turned into a civil war with indigenous people, armed by the government, turning on each other rather than fighting the Maoists. Human rights activists are questioning the rationale behind supporting Salwa Judim movement and are asking for its immediate abolition. FSRN's Ben Alex reports.
In the province of Chhattisgarh, Mahendra Karma, a Congress politician, created Salwa Judim, a campaign for peace, as a movement to arm local villagers against Maoist attacks. Recently, a group comprised of academics, rights activists, and journalists conducted a study of Maoist affected areas and estimated that around 1,000 innocent civilians had been killed in Salwa Judim since the nearly year-old revolt began. Around 50,000 displaced villagers currently live in camps along the main roads without basic means of livelihood. According to the government, villagers are so terrorized by the Maoists that they prefer to live like refugees in camps rather than in their villages. Ramchandra Guha, historian and sociologist, was one of the members of the initiative.
Incidents of violence have increased, and so the conflict has escalated. If this movement was conceived as a peace initiative, then it seems to have seriously failed.
Starting from Nepal and running through the central Indian provinces of Bihar, Jharkhand and Chhattisgarh till the South Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, alleged left-wing extremists operate in a vast but poverty-struck territory and claim to fight for the rights of poor peasants and landless laborers. The federal government says it is keen to uproot left-wing extremism. The government has so far not accepted the findings and said it was based more on presumption rather than hard facts. Some human rights activists like Jesuit priest Xavier Manjuran say that arming local villagers with weapons could be dangerous precedents.
They have no education, they have no organization, and they are not aware of their own rights. Tribals by nature, because of the long exploitation and lack of education, they are rather slow in understanding the thing. So you have to make the tribal understand the implications of this, what is happening, and then as a result, what will happen to their future.
Under the Salvajira movement, the government armed untrained and underage youths in villages and designated them as special police officers or SPOs. The fact-finding group found incidents of killing, burnings of homes, attacks on women by these SPOs. The group recommended that to control Maoists, the government needs to address their legitimate demands. Most of these demands relate to underdevelopment. The rebellion is attributed to government failure in providing schools, hospitals and roads in these remote areas. Moreover, mining, water and energy management policies have discriminated against these aboriginals who then sympathize with the Maoists to take up violence. Retired bureaucrat E.S. Sharma says the Maoist problem can be solved through dialogue and not through counter-violence.
There is no question of the Home Ministry or somebody throwing some money at Chhattisgarh or Andhra Pradesh and saying, look, I've given you the money and the problem is solved. No, unconditional ceasefire. And two, discussion of the issues. And this must be a national dialogue, a national initiative.
The movement, described by the government as a spontaneous, self-initiated peace mission, was severely criticized by Amnesty International and the Asian Center for Human Rights. But the government, instead, is all set to celebrate the first anniversary of the movement, with the number of people having become refugees in their own homeland swelling, and a police force which is hardly equipped or trained to deal with the problem. From Rajpipla in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Liberia has started recruiting women into its new post-war army as part of a drive to ensure gender balance throughout the country. The plan is endorsed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first democratically elected woman to lead an African country. About 400 of the 2,000 troops will be women. Officials said that the women recruits will be able to serve in whatever capacity they qualify for.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 6, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 23203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Tonight's audio editors are Lisa Loving and Angela Hancock Revis. Special thanks to reporters Amy Verwin, Jacob Feston, and Stephanie Potter. Our engineer is Judy Fespisto. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Jo Sonia Watson.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, hear Barbara Bernstein, who hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. Her guest is Eileen Brady of EcoTrust and New Seasons Market. They'll discuss sustainable agriculture and saving Oregon strawberries. At 9 on the KBOO Bike Show, hear about Petalalapuzla, the two-week festival of bike events. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller investigates the state's secrets privilege from its dubious origin in the 1950s to the Bush regime's expansive use of the concept. William Weaver, associate professor of political science at the University of Texas, El Paso, an expert on the privilege, and Michael Avery, law professor at Suffolk University, who is assisting the Center for Constitutional Rights in battling Bush's use of the privilege, both join Andrew. At 10:30, Marianne Varsonic interviews reporter Aaron Glantz, author of How America Lost Iraq, and co-author of the recent articles Multiply Haditha by Thousands and Basra Explodes. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 6th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Last month's failing report by Canada's Auditor General may help some First Nation leaders in the Yukon get their message to Ottawa. The AG, Sheila Fraser, was critical of the way Aboriginal programs are managed, including housing initiatives. The CBC's Doris Bill has more on the story.
Housing is a pressing issue across the north. In the small central Yukon community of Carmax, the problems are urgent. Some residents have been forced from their homes because of mold. The community has also issued a boil water advisory for its citizens because of an inadequate water and sewer system. Ottawa has given some money to First Nations on reserve for things like mold, but most Yukon First Nation communities are excluded. That's because they are not reserves, but are self-governing. The chief of CARMAX says getting Ottawa to pay attention to some of the issues is a lot tougher than it used to be. Chief Eddie Skookum.
We thought in the first instance when we passed all our motions to become a self-governing nation, that we could get a handle on those dollars, but apparently somewhere down the line the rules changed.
The Auditor General's report says the federal government has made some progress. One example is the recent announcement of $300 million for housing across the north. That money is supposed to go to putting families in affordable homes. Skookum is pleased with the money, but says they should be able to spend it on their most pressing needs. Yukon chiefs will be taking their message to Ottawa in the wake of the Auditor General's report. They want to urge the federal government to live up to its obligations that are laid out in Yukon land claim agreements. Doris Bill, Whitehorse.
A coalition of Native American groups in South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming are struggling to stop a proposed biker bar and campground from going in near the sacred site of Bear Butte. The site is near the massive Sturgis Rally, which draws in a 500,000 bikers once a year. Citizens are calling for a public vote to reverse the malt beverage license given to the establishment. But whether or not there will be an election is up to the courts. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray has the story.
Meade County citizens opposed to the issuing of a malt beverage license for a biker campground near Bear Butte petitioned for a public vote, but the county commission is refusing to hold an election. Bruce Ellison is one of three attorneys who have filed a case in circuit court. Ellison says the commission has denied citizens their democratic right.
To me, it's very disturbing as a citizen of the state when any governing body refuses to perform their statutory legal obligations, their duties, especially in this instance where for over 90 years this has been the law in South Dakota, and to even claim otherwise suggests a certain hostility towards democracy.
But the state's attorney for Meade County, Ken Klubberad, says the granting of a malt beverage license is an administrative act, not a legislative one. So he says it's not referable to the voters. Opponents to the malt beverage license hope the courts disagree and grant a referendum before the biker rally in August. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
There's a deal in the works to prevent the export of a rare coat made by Innu artists in the 1700s. The painted caribou skin coat is now owned by an art dealer in Toronto. Last year, a private American buyer tried to purchase the coat for $180,000. Government regulations have given Canadian buyers until June 9th to intervene. Now it looks like the Rooms Provincial Museum, Labrador's Innu Nation, and Canadian Heritage will pool their resources to buy the coat. Museum Director Penny Holden says the province would act as the artifact's caretaker until the Innu acquire proper facilities to store and display it.
At that point in time, the coat will be transferred to the Innu Nation, which means that they would have something available for exhibition and for study at all times in Labrador.
Holden says negotiations are ongoing with the owner of the coat. William Jameson says he's willing to reduce his price to $130,000 if it means the artifact will stay in Canada. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News.